per poter dire al mondo l'ho baciata. Se tu fossi regina,
morning.
Hey, I tell you something?
Yeah.
I'm sitting at the window. There's a draft here. A draft of cold air coming in.
Okay.
And I said to my mom, because downstairs we got a lot of old doors, and I said to my mom, you know, there's a draft here. We can close that up. And you know what she said to me? She said, "Are you kidding? The draft in this house, that's what's been keeping us alive for 30 years."
Well, I think that's fucking right.
Yeah, so make me think of you in the cabin.
Yeah, yeah. This fucking thing leaks like a sieve. And any kind of wind blows. I mean, we got your wind right here, boys. It comes right in the front and goes right out the back. The cabin itself is a railroad. You know, you've been here, so you know it's a railroad style apartment cabin like you have in New York, but all the rooms just attached to each other, so there's no fucking privacy. But we got the front room, and then we got the next room, and then we got my studio part. And yeah, the wind blows right through there. It's terrific. The cat loves it.
I had a question. It's a question about writing.
Yeah. Okay.
And the problem I have with trying to write, because you asked me some time ago if I've been writing, and I said, no, I haven't been writing. And you said, well, I'm in the gathering of information stage. And
I
like that. But I think the reason why I'm not writing, well, I know the reason why I'm not writing, is I want to write about what's happening now. But there's so much that I didn't get to before that I haven't written about. It's like a backlog, you know?
Right, right.
And so as soon as I hit the paper there, I'm reminded of the, you know, the 100 days behind me that need to be dealt with. And that's just too much, that's just too much work. And so I end up getting discouraged, and I leave the whole thing behind.
Yep. So all of that.
So how do I solve this?
You don't. But I'll tell you this, though. I went through the very same fucking thing. The learning how to be a writer on your own limb, you know, without going to some school or something like that. So when you start, that's right. You want to write about blah, blah. I was living in New York when I really decided I wanted to have a real go at this. And so I was going to go around writing about New York. But the reality was, that's not what I wrote at all. I wrote, you know, every time I sat down with the pencil, I'm just started talking about, like, years ago, or the old man, and blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't very good. But it was so bad. I recognized that finally that I just quit doing it. I just wouldn't get on with life. I just get on with life. I got married, and Victoria had a lot of money, so we were a wonderful person, of course. But she's the mother of my daughter, so she's a wonderful person. And my daughter is a wonderful person. Wait a little. But meanwhile, so then I took a few years out and just studied. That's when I went to Gurdjieff and the gang in Big Sur. That's when I went there. I wasn't writing, and they didn't know me as someone who would write. And I just started learning. I thought, okay, so I want to be I am a writer. So in my own mind, I've been a writer my whole life, but I didn't know how to do it, and so I stopped, and then I gained information, then I came back. Only now I knew what was important to write about. It was not an intellectual decision about what to write about. It was just, that's what I wrote about. And then studying the piles, I realized what I was writing about. And I was trying to figure out the mysteries. And so I was writing about trying to figure out the mysteries. You know, I wrote a story about the native peoples always left a gift of tobacco at a waterfall because they felt that the electricity from the waterfall helped in the birth of children, of their children. And so when they came upon a waterfall, and the ones I'm talking about, forest Indians back where I come from, back in northern Ontario, there's lots of waterfalls. And so my thought there was that in terms of like, well, one of the earliest metaphysical attempts that I made was this idea where that I was going to have this man stop at this waterfall, this Native American man, stop at this waterfall and make an offering of tobacco. And then make an offering of some sort to the waterfall, and just happen, you know, acknowledging the fact that the waterfall and the spark that it, the electric spark that it generates, is part of the birth process. And so, so I wrote that a little bit, and it wasn't very good, but I liked the idea, but I didn't really. The piece was lame, but the idea was good, and so I kept it. I didn't bother to throw it away, but So.
What about the backlog?
I gave up on it. I did. I spent all the years before I went to Big Sur. In the 5 or 7 years from New York to Big Sur, I wrote about my father. I didn't, but I'm not going to go into a long thing about my father on this tape. But other than that, I wrote almost everything I wrote involved in him one way or another, his spirit or this or that or what. And he and I didn't get along. He was a tough nut. And so he was a hockey player and in a time when it was different, but they didn't wear helmets, so they whacked each other over the head. I played in that league, but up until Big Sur, I wrote about my father, and then one day I just got it right. I just realized to myself, well, that's about the best I can do after like 400 attempts at my father. I got him. Bingo. Done. Finished. Out the door, man. And so then loomed the mother part, the continent of ghosts part, you know, the thing there. And so I've been sitting on that fucking thing since Big Sur, really. Like for 40 years, I've been sitting on this continent of ghosts idea where my mother is just outside my eye, flickering over there, always present but never seen. And so and then I got her, the continent of ghosts. That's it. I'm done. So in fact, I may be done writing very much. I am going to do this bit though that you've asked me to do. I look forward to the challenge of it. But we're thinking about just a short paragraph, okay?
In terms of what you're going to be reading.
No, in terms of the little bio thing for the bio thing.
Oh, yeah. We just need to set you in three-dimensional space, and that'll hopefully hook enough people in when they read it.
Okay.
You know, because you're not in some everyday.
It's very simple. I have this, when people say this or that, I say that I live in a $1 million location in a $10 house. I mean, where I live, only the very, very rich or the very, very poor can live where I live, simply because it's a berm that sticks into a river that's right next to the ocean. I mean, I'm right at the mouth. I'm just at the estuary of this river, and the ocean is just right over there. So, and there's nobody else down here but me on this long berm that sticks out, and the road is way the fuck up the hill there. So nobody comes down here. I have it here. It's very excellent, really. Yeah, I have an outhouse, so that's the only thing. But yeah, you get used to it. You know, I think I spent most of my fucking life in dealing with an outhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My friend's place in. Well, you become a kind of expert on the goddamn thing after a while. And what you don't want is an updraft. And my pal over there, in Hawaii, his outhouse sat on the edge of a thing. It was a two-holer. You got to have a two-holer, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it is odd to sit right next to somebody who's reading the paper, and you're reading the paper, and we're both pooping. But my friend's place over there in Hawaii, it was on the edge of a kind of a dugout area there, so the draft came shooting right up. Like, you know, so there you are sitting on the thing in the morning trying to, like, figure out who I am here. Who am I going to be today? Am I going to be Tarzan, or am I going to wear a cape of some sort? And there suddenly the wind comes whipping right up, curls the hairs. I could do it. Hey, listen, you want 10 minutes on outhouse? I could audition. No, I can do outhouses. No question about it. I've had them my whole life. Well, when Michael came to the farm in Quebec, he knew that. I mean, he saw our outhouse there.
Yeah.
So don't tell me the truth now. These people who are coming in on this private line thing.
Yeah.
They, so we can edit this thing shit out, or anyway. Are we getting a general idea that they're approving of the thing, or they think it's fucking crazy?
Well, first of all, it is fucking crazy, and they do think it's fucking crazy. And everybody I've spoken to, they love it.
Okay.
Aside from one person said something. Something rather rude, and I asked them how much they listened to it, and they said they listened to about 4 or 9 minutes of it. And I said, well, go back and listen to the whole thing, and then make your judgment. I mean, I'm not expecting everybody to like it or understand it.
No, we don't care.
Yeah. But make an informed judgment, that's for sure.
It's all right.
So what about this line, I took the goat and I healed the kid?
What? What did you just say?
Well, it's something you said. You said, I took the goat and I healed the kid.
Oh, yeah. That was, yeah. And what was the question?
What about it? What does that mean? I mean, I'm taking it out of...
Well, it means that you can set yourself up as some sort of guru, up on some sort of mountain, and then the local dummies, you know, you do a couple of fake healings, you bring in a Hindu. Hindus are good. You can pierce them a lot of times. They don't die. They never die. Hindus never die. They're good. Very good. But, they're very good. One, they're excellent, really. I don't want some fucking whatever. I would spot the guy a mile and a half off. But, any event, though, we would edit that shit out. We don't want to upset Hindus. We know all about them. So I set myself up as a guru person.
Uh-huh.
And then the locals down below there, they come up. I do a couple of fake healings, as I say. I hire a Hindu and pierces himself a lot, and I go, yahoo, yahoo, and up he jumps, and away he goes. So people are really impressed out below, and they're eating their cornflakes and their corn, their corn chips, and their corn, really. But then they got some little Joey there. He's busting his fucking legs, so they call him up the hill, and I'm up there, and I'm, well, I ain't doing this for nothing. This isn't a charity. We're not doing charity work here. No. And so up they come, and so they got this little guy, and he's got his busted leg, and I say, okay, well, let's have a look. And then I have a look, and I say, he's probably fucking doomed. One goat, please. And then off they go. I charge him a goat, because they got no fucking money.
Well, I think goats are really fantastic. For one thing, goat will eat all the weeds, all of the stuff that the other animals, like a cow, will not eat.
Yeah.
They're easier to transport. They make better cheese.
Better cheese?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Goat's milk cheese. It's like there's a different pH, I think, in the milk. There's something about it, you know.
We got goats on the ranch here. But we have a whole fucking herd of goats.
Well, you should squeeze some of that milk into your coffee.
Good idea.
I mean,
the two women who run the goat deal here on the ranch, they were selling the milk or doing something.
Raw goat's milk is probably the elixir of life, and when you make it sour, when you turn it into kefir, which is what they drink in the mountains of the Himalayas, these people live forever.
Yeah, they do. Well, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Okay.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, this is good. This is good information. Yeah. Yeah, I have them right fucking handy. They're like the lady, one of the ladies in the ranch kept bees for a while. And I bought a whole lot of excellent local honey. They tell you they say the local honey, if you eat the honey from the local bees, you're immune to laryngitis.
Oh, I mean the paradise out there around us, if it's untouched, it's all set up for our well-being.
No, totally right on. I mean, everything you ever fucking need is right outside my window here. No. Forever and ever. Oh, man. But the river, it's rained hard. And when the rain's really hard, the river gets roiled up. The river becomes kind of angry and bustles up. Under most normal circumstances, it's kind of calm.
Yeah.
Right here at the ocean area, because we're open to the waves coming. You know, we've got a big sand dune between us and the ocean. You couldn't live here if you didn't have a big sand dune.
Mm-hmm.
Our beach here is 7 miles long. I mean, there's never anybody on it, though, of course, because it's colder than hell. And the wind comes out of the north and never fucking quits out there at the beach. I only go out there if somebody comes to visit and they want to go to the beach. I say, why do we have to go to the beach? And so they blah, blah, the 7 miles part.
But, well, we always jump in. Every time I come down there, we jump in.
Yeah, it's cold.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, it is cold. But and it's dangerous where you guys went, and I kept an eye on you because there's riptides out just on our...
Oh, yeah.
Our beach is rather dangerous also, amongst other things. But being cold and windy and dangerous, that's why there isn't anybody on it. But
they've all been washed out to sea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's no fucking road to the thing either, so nobody wants to lug the lawn chair and the 9 pounds of shit that they carried to the beach with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my daughter told me that in order for her to go to the beach, she lives in Mexico, on the beach in Mexico, that to go to the, but it was a ways off, that to go to the beach, they take like 94 pounds of shit out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if they can't drive right up to the thing, they're not going to walk out to our beach.
Well, you should say hello to these goats, I think. It could become...
Well, you piqued my interest.
They could become allies.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah. And you know, another thing is... in Switzerland, we were ordering organic vegetable boxes that come straight from a farm. And I think the vegetables there, on a whole, are much more vegetable-y than they are here now. I think they've done some dark stuff to our food over here. And the organic vegetables in the box from the farm there, a carrot tastes like a carrot. You don't need to cook it. If you do cook it, you just have a little oil, a little bit of salt, nothing else. You could eat anything, a turnip, a cabbage, a leek, a potato. You can't imagine the flavors that come out of these little packages. It's like seeing in color. Hmm. And I think really they've done something to our food. When you
as the renegade gardener in the hills, I did learn a couple of things about what you're talking about there. And it's also possible that that in Switzerland, they have worked the soil. They understand the benefits of having good soil. The food grows in. And I don't think over here, frankly, agro business, as they call it now, I don't think they really give a shit about the soil. I mean, I learned in the marijuana growing business that just the mix of the soil in the box produced quite a bit of a different plant from the one next door, which was just basically dirt tossed in and a little water, and off it went. Whereas on my side, working the soil with compost and everything else. So I think they take better care of their soil right out of the box. That would make for better veggies.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, they modify these seeds genetically.
All right.
They go in with teams of scientists, and they inject certain DNAs and, they're messing with with God's plan.
HMOs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, it's the same, man. It's the same with meat. I mean, in 1910, a chicken cost $7 of today's money, and now it costs what, $1.50. People didn't eat chicken every day. They didn't eat these huge fucking things that were sick and dying and tired, cramped into cages. They ate something that was wild, that was running around. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not a historian, but once a month.
I grew up with chickens. Yeah, yeah. No, you're absolutely fucking right.
They're killing us softly.
You're just trying to do the best you can do.
Yeah.
But at
the end of the day, I think you can transmute all of this. And in macrobiotics, and I'm sure Gurdjieff thinks the same way, if you chew your food 100 times, you get rid of the poison. It's alchemy. You can assimilate anything.
Yeah.
You just have to know what you're doing.
This is back in the 1920s, before HMOs. But in the 1920s, Gurdjieff said, "Try to swallow your food whole." Basically, he said the stomach needs to work, and so his idea was that chewing the stuff up into mush was easy on the stomach. Gurdjieff said, "You got to eat big chunks." And then that gives us something to do.
Mm.
And once again, it's paralysis by analysis. I mean,
I wonder if you could do it back then, but now because it's so full of poison, you have to.
That was what I was suggesting.
Uh-huh.
In the 1920s, you probably could. But I'm not sure at this point in time now.
Yeah.
A big lump. But on the other hand, I mean, here in the local little town there, you know, which I'm not going to bother talking about, but in the local town, we got your garden, we got your outdoor street garden thingy there that people bring in vegetables from all around, and the locals are very, the local gardener, vegetable people are very hip to the HMOs. We had a whole big fucking thing in the county here about HMOs. Well, we had a big marching, and I still got the bumper sticker, I think, because they tried to put HMOs into something or other here locally, and the whole fucking county reacted to it. But, of course, the next county over, they went right for it. Yeah, and the wind blows that, you know. Mm-hmm. If the county over there is poisoning the goddamn land, the wind blows some of that poison over onto your land. So, oh well. But we can't deal with negativity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just what it is, and we just try to do the best we can, and there's a sunny day, not a cloud is in the sky, not a negative word from the people passing by.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Lulu Sue, and he was a Navy boy. Rock and roll is here to stay.
What did you tell me? What's the first thing you told me when you picked up the phone? You had a sentence there.
Oh, a long time, a couple of Lulus ago. Now you're asking for difficult. This is what was I on about?
You remember? You had a nice sentence.
No, I don't.
Well, let's go on with the idea of the $1 million location in a $10 house. Can we go in that direction? I mean, with this thing that you're going to write, if I can suggest a direction.
Yes, totally. Go.
Well, I'd like to follow that.
Oh, okay.
The $1 million location in a $10 house.
Yeah.
So.
Ants. We got your ants. We got every kind. This is a fucking swamp. But I live in a swamp. I live in a berm. A berm is a man-made thing that was built by men. Because historically, back up the watershed there where the hill, big hills are, we had big redwood trees. And at the turn of the century, like about 1912 or something like that, back in the really old days, they logged all the big redwoods out of up there. But they had no fucking roads. So they brought them down by water. When the rains came, the river got real big, and they rolled all the big old logs down into the water. And then the big old logs came shooting down the river, heading towards the ocean. And so down by the ocean where I live, down the river, they built little half dams to sort of slow the log gang get down, because the log gang was going to be coming down around a few bends for about a mile and a half or 2 miles or so. And by the time it hit the ocean, it would be going at a pretty good speed, and you weren't going to be able to stop it. So the idea, when the old boys, they were smart, the engineer guys, they figured, well, we won't let them get going very fast, because we'll build a bunch of bloody blocks in the fucking river halfway down, so they'll bump into it, and that'll slow them way down, which is what happened. And nobody rode on them, it would have been away from fucking dangerous. They just sailed them down loose, but they traveled in a pack. You don't need to tie them up. And so, down here where I live, down near the ocean part, so they got them slowed down, and then they get down here. Well, they got to get them out of the river by truck. They got to have, they had trucks and stuff in those days, maybe it's the 20s. But the trucks are up on the fucking road, up on the hill there, and you got to drop down into the swamp, down a hill, maybe about, a couple hundred yards, we'll say. But it's a steep little hill, but it runs down into the flush with the river. The road's up above, because I can't put the goddamn road down with the river. So it broke us up above, and that was good. So then they decided to, they got to get logs out of the river, so they got to have build a road. So they do. They build, when they bring back, they back down, I'm sure, old trucks full of gravel, and they build it up and build it up. And they build the berm about 7 feet above the river level, and they build it. It runs for like 100 yards. It runs in a big sort of semi-curve out toward, why they curved it, I have no idea why they just didn't run it straight, but they didn't. Anyway, they build it about 7 feet up off the river, and then they build it right out to the river edge, and then they build a huge dock out there, and then they put a huge grabber deal, big logs and poles and shit, and the guy was sitting in the thing and grabbing up the logs, and then the log trucks would back down. Then they paved the thing in tarmac. That's right. They made it into a road, a road wide enough for two trucks. And so the berm is wide enough for two trucks, a little bit wider, and it's tarmac. And logging trucks would back down there out to the river. The grabber would grab the big old logs up, whap them on the log truck, and then they'd drive out up the fucking hill and off to the sawmill up the coast a ways. So that was the ticky there. And so, well, then eventually logging, they built roads out the logging thing, and too many logs would sail out to sea. Yeah, and the smart guys, so the logs would sail, even to this day, the same trick happens. The log, if a log comes down the river, a stray log just gets out in the river, and comes down and then goes right on by my cabin, it goes out into the ocean, but it didn't go very far. So the ocean just carries it up about, maybe half a mile and dumps it out on a beach up there, up a ways. So if I see something good going by in the morning, then I know like in about 4 or 5 hours it's going to be up on this beach up there. So I drive up there to have a look at it if I want it. And other boys come and they saw the thing up and so on. So local information there. But okay, so we got the berm. The truck's going, coming and going, then it's over. They bring the logs out by road. No need for the berms, no need for the thing. You know, things they just wander off. Leave it. There's the berm. It's part of a huge ranch, a 400-acre ranch that I live on. That berm doesn't belong to me. I don't own any of this shit. But So then there it is, and there it is from like 1920 to 19.
You own the cabin.
No, the cabin, there's nothing built here. Then there was a cabin built up a little old shack built up a bit, and that's where the guy who ran the grabber, he lived in there, and he had a garage, because the fucking thing was paved, they weren't really doing it much. So he had a garage down here, where the front room is of the house. Then, about years later, I don't know what, in the 50s, his place burnt down, so he moved away, and my pal, who is a poet fella, Dwayne Bingo, he comes in, and he sees the garage, and he makes a deal with the people, and he turns it into a wonderful one-room studio. Then Dwayne decides to go and teach Native American history down at San Jose State or some fucking place. So he leaves and gives me the front room, and we move in there, and then we build another studio and another studio. And so it's all been just slapdash together. There's no kitchen, of course, but we got two huge stoves. We got Morley in the front room, and then we got a Yodel in the back room here where I am. And but outside, we got your water trees, got your alders and your birches. And right now they're all bare. I see them sometimes. If I'm looking down on them from up above the car park, and I'm looking down at my house, I see these bare trees as like stick figures, you know, like martial, sort of Germanic in their intent. And I see them all marching around the cabin, and I think to myself, well, in the summertime, those little Marshall buggers are covered up. They're covered in camel leaves. And in these camel leaves live little birds, little canopy birds, and they fly around like crazy and they eat all the bugs and shit. And then they all go away, the canopy birds and the leaves. Then I just have the martial arts again. And sometimes they affect my day. Sometimes if someone came past the rope I have across the driveway and the sign that says, "Keep out," that's on my side of the rope. Some days, someone came through there, was rude, and didn't want to leave. There might be some days when I would pick up the axe and chop their fucking hand off. But those are just some days when the trees are bare. There's no fucking leaves. But it's dramatic in the mood. Yeah, so what fucking time is it? Let me look at my watch. What time is it?
It's over. It's all over now.
So we missed yesterday. What? Tell me your schedule.
Why don't I call you back? We have an afterthought here.
Okay. I heard what you said. I will write that shit up. Hang on. Bye bye.
All right.